From NPR News in Washington, this is special live coverage of President George W. Bush's address to the nation. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block from the White House. In a few moments, the president will speak to Americans as well as people listening and watching around the world. His message, an ultimatum for Saddam Hussein, step down from power and leave Iraq or face war. With us now is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, White House advisors are saying the president will be giving Saddam Hussein 48 hours before a U.S.-led invasion begins. Is that, in fact, the timetable?
It sounds like it. He wants to give Saddam Hussein one last chance to leave with his family. There's no thinking at the White House that Saddam Hussein will actually take him up on that offer, but it is kind of the final ultimatum, final chance to avoid the destruction of much of his country, although not the final chance to avoid U.S. troops going in. They would go in any event. What Colin Powell talked about this morning was basically the peaceful entry of force.
And are we also likely to hear the president explain why the U.S. has abandoned efforts to push for U.N. backing?
Yes, I think you'll hear the president echo some of the comments he's already made, that the U.N. has failed to disarm Saddam Hussein.
We are waiting for the president. He will be walking down the red carpet of the Cross Hall in the White House. I understand that carpet is 74 feet long. It will be a lengthy trip to the microphone for the president as he prepares the nation for a possible war with Iraq. Mara, this speech comes after a news conference just 10 days ago in which the president said, we're going to call for a vote.
Right, and they decided not to.
And we're waiting for the president. Here he is.
My fellow citizens, events in Iraq have now reached the final days of decision. For more than a decade, the United States and other nations have pursued patient and honorable efforts to disarm the Iraqi regime without war. That regime pledged to reveal and destroy all its weapons of mass destruction as a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War in 1991. Since then, the world has engaged in 12 years of diplomacy. We have passed more than a dozen resolutions in the United Nations Security Council. We have sent hundreds of weapons inspectors to oversee the disarmament of Iraq. Our good faith has not been returned. The Iraqi regime has used diplomacy as a ploy to gain time and advantage. It has uniformly defied Security Council resolutions demanding full disarmament. Over the years, UN weapon inspectors have been threatened by Iraqi officials, electronically bugged, and systematically deceived. Peaceful efforts to disarm the Iraqi regime have failed again and again because we are not dealing with peaceful men. Intelligence gathered by this and other governments leaves no doubt that the Iraqi regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised. This regime has already used weapons of mass destruction against Iraq's neighbors and against Iraq's people. The regime has a history of reckless aggression in the Middle East. It has a deep hatred of America and our friends, and it has aided, trained and harbored terrorists, including operatives of Al-Qaeda. The danger is clear. Using chemical, biological, or one-day nuclear weapons obtained with the help of Iraq, the terrorists could fulfill their stated ambitions and kill thousands or hundreds of thousands of innocent people in our country or any other. The United States and other nations did nothing to deserve or invite this threat, but we will do everything to defeat it. Instead of drifting along toward tragedy, we will set a course toward safety. Before the day of horror can come, before it is too late to act, this danger will be removed. The United States of America has the sovereign authority to use force in assuring its own national security. That duty falls to me as Commander-in-Chief. By the oath I have sworn, by the oath I will keep. Recognizing the threat to our country, the United States Congress voted overwhelmingly last year to support the use of force against Iraq. America tried to work with the United Nations to address this threat because we wanted to resolve the issue peacefully. We believe in the mission of the United Nations. One reason the UN was founded after the Second World War was to confront aggressive dictators actively and early, before they can attack the innocent and destroy the peace. In the case of Iraq, the Security Council did act in the early 1990s. Under resolutions 678 and 687, both still in effect, the United States and our allies are authorized to use force in ridding Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. This is not a question of authority. It is a question of will. Last September, I went to the UN General Assembly and urged the nations of the world to unite and bring an end to this danger. On November 8th, the Security Council unanimously passed Resolution 1441, finding Iraq in material breach of its obligations and vowing serious consequences if Iraq did not fully and immediately disarm. Today, no nation can possibly claim that Iraq has disarmed, and it will not disarm so long as Saddam Hussein holds power. For the last 4.5 months, the United States and our allies have worked within the Security Council to enforce that Council's long-standing demands. Yet some permanent members of the Security Council have publicly announced they will veto any resolution that compels the disarmament of Iraq. These governments share our assessment of the danger, but not our resolve to meet it. Many nations, however, do have the resolve and fortitude to act against this threat to peace. And a broad coalition is now gathering to enforce the just demands of the world. The United Nations Security Council has not lived up to its responsibilities, so we will rise to ours. In recent days, some governments in the Middle East have been doing their part. They have delivered public and private messages urging the dictator to leave Iraq so that disarmament can proceed peacefully. He has thus far refused. All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing. For their own safety, all foreign nationals, including journalists and inspectors, should leave Iraq immediately. Many Iraqis can hear me tonight in a translated radio broadcast, and I have a message for them. If we must begin a military campaign, it will be directed against the lawless men who rule your country and not against you. As our coalition takes away their power, we will deliver the food and medicine you need. We will tear down the apparatus of terror, and we will help you to build a new Iraq that is prosperous and free. In a free Iraq, there will be no more wars of aggression against your neighbors, no more poison factories, no more executions of dissidents, no more torture chambers and rape rooms. The tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near. It is too late for Saddam Hussein to remain in power. It is not too late for the Iraqi military to act with honor and protect your country by permitting the peaceful entry of coalition forces to eliminate weapons of mass destruction. Our forces will give Iraqi military units clear instructions on actions they can take to avoid being attacked and destroyed. I urge every member of the Iraqi military and intelligence services, if war comes, do not fight for a dying regime that is not worth your own life. And all Iraqi military and civilian personnel should listen carefully to this warning. In any conflict, your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells, a source of wealth that belongs to the Iraqi people. Do not obey any command to use weapons of mass destruction against anyone, including the Iraqi people. War crimes will be prosecuted. War criminals will be punished. And it will be no defense to say, I was just following orders. Should Saddam Hussein choose confrontation, the American people can know that every measure has been taken to avoid war, and every measure will be taken to win it. Americans understand the cost of conflict because we have paid them in the past. War has no certainty except the certainty of sacrifice. Yet the only way to reduce the harm and duration of war is to apply the full force and might of our military, and we are prepared to do so. If Saddam Hussein attempts to cling to power, he will remain a deadly foe until the end. In desperation, he and terrorist groups might try to conduct terrorist operations against the American people and our friends. These attacks are not inevitable. They are, however, possible. And this very fact underscores the reason we cannot live under the threat of blackmail. The terrorist threat to America and the world will be diminished the moment that Saddam Hussein is disarmed. Our government is on heightened watch against these dangers. Just as we are preparing to ensure victory in Iraq, we are taking further actions to protect our homeland. In recent days, American authorities have expelled from the country certain individuals with ties to Iraqi intelligence services. Among other measures, I have directed additional security at our airports and increased Coast Guard patrols of major seaports. The Department of Homeland Security is working closely with the nation's governors to increase armed security at critical facilities across America. Should enemies strike our country, they would be attempting to shift our attention with panic and weaken our morale with fear. In this, they would fail. No act of theirs can alter the course or shake the resolve of this country. We are a peaceful people, yet we're not a fragile people, and we will not be intimidated by thugs and killers. If our enemies dare to strike us, they and all who have aided them will face fearful consequences. We are now acting because the risks of inaction would be far greater. In 1 year or 5 years, the power of Iraq to inflict harm on all free nations would be multiplied many times over. With these capabilities, Saddam Hussein and his terrorist allies could choose the moment of deadly conflict when they are strongest. We choose to meet that threat now, where it arises, before it can appear suddenly in our skies and cities. The cause of peace requires all free nations to recognize new and undeniable realities. In the 20th century, some chose to appease murderous dictators whose threats were allowed to grow into genocide and global war. In this century, when evil men plot chemical, biological, and nuclear terror, a policy of appeasement could bring destruction of a kind never before seen on this earth. Terrorists and terror states do not reveal these threats with fair notice in formal declarations. And responding to such enemies only after they have struck first is not self-defense, it is suicide. The security of the world requires disarming Saddam Hussein now. As we enforce the just demands of the world, we will also honor the deepest commitments of our country. Unlike Saddam Hussein, we believe the Iraqi people are deserving and capable of human liberty. And when the dictator has departed, they can set an example to all the Middle East of a vital and peaceful and self-governing nation. The United States, with other countries, will work to advance liberty and peace in that region. Our goal will not be achieved overnight, but it can come over time. The power and appeal of human liberty is felt in every life and every land. And the greatest power of freedom is to overcome hatred and violence and turn the creative gifts of men and women to the pursuits of peace. That is the future we choose. Free nations have a duty to defend our people by uniting against the violent. And tonight, as we have done before, America and our allies accept that responsibility. Good night, And may God continue to bless America.
You've been listening to live coverage of President Bush's address to the nation from NPR News. With us now to recap quickly the highlights of the speech is NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Mara, what would you say are the key points we should take from the speech?
Well, the key points are we're going to war, and President Bush made it about as clear as he could. He gave Saddam Hussein and his sons 48 hours to leave. He said a broad coalition is now gathering, and he put the UN on notice. He said the United Nations Security Council has not fulfilled its responsibilities, and we will now rise to ours. And I think he gave the clearest and most detailed explanation of his doctrine of preventive war that I've heard yet. This is not a preemptive war. In other words, Iraq is not massing to attack us, and we're preempting them. In fact, we're preventing something that could happen, as the president said, in 1 year or 5 years. But he said that we have no alternative but to act now to stop it, because terrorists don't give advance warning, and by the time they're ready to take action against the United States at a time of their own choosing, it will be too late.
He also mentioned this sort of hearkening back implicitly to 9/11, threats coming from the skies over our cities. Free nations, he said, have a duty to defend our people by uniting against the violent. Mara?
That's right. I think that he also spoke a little bit about the risks and costs. That's something that his critics have been complaining that he hasn't done enough of. He said this won't be easy. The only thing certain about war is sacrifice. And he also said that the U.S. will work with others to rebuild Iraq. He spent quite a bit of time speaking to the Iraqi military, which I thought was interesting, telling them in a quite detailed way that there will be war crimes, trials, that saying you're following orders will not be a defense. He said, don't use weapons of mass destruction against your own people or others. And your lives and the lives of your families are not worth fighting for a dying regime. I think all along the White House has hoped that there would be some kind of a coup or the Iraqi generals would rise up. And as a matter of fact, one White House official told me one of the reasons that they started talking about regime change again, after having dropped that phrase for quite a while and focusing on disarmament, is they wanted to remind the Iraqi leadership that regime change was the goal, and they didn't want them to think that Saddam Hussein was still going to be in power. So he spent quite a bit of time talking directly to the Iraqi military.
The American public, by a 2-to-1 margin, generally supports military action, Mara. So how much of a sales job did he have to do tonight?
Oh, I think he has to do a sales job. American people support the war effort now. There certainly will be a rally effect after the bombs start falling, and I think those numbers will go up. But I think the president knows that there was a lot of ambivalence about this. Polls showed, along with that support for the war, there was equal support for letting the UN weapons inspectors have more time. And I think the president knows that if something goes wrong, if this is not the short, relatively costless conflict that the first Persian Gulf War was, he could run into trouble with the American people. So he has to maintain support there. And I think that that's something that's foremost in the White House mind.
Okay. Thanks, Mara. NPR's Mara Liasson.
I'm Melissa Block with live special coverage of President Bush's address to the nation. And let's turn now to NPR news analyst Daniel Schorr. Dan, 48 hours for Saddam Hussein and his sons to leave the country to...
That's right. But then an open-ended period after that, before the war comes. The president was very careful to say, your deadline is 48 hours. Then we decide what we're going to do. Certainly, boldness was not lacking in the president's speech. Well, until now, he spoke of serious consequences in UN Security Council Resolution 1441 of last November. Those have now become fearful consequences. The president did repeat a lot of things he has said before. He continues to insist, although others have challenged it, that that Iraq was actually helping in terrorist attacks and helping them to prepare for an act, which, by the way, he apparently expects may happen. Apparently, they've gone back up to an orange alert. They're beginning to take extra measures in the next few days. The assumption is that if and when the fighting starts, there may indeed be terrorist attempts to counter that.
He mentioned a broad coalition forming against Saddam Hussein. What's that coalition looking like?
Looks like the United States and Britain and Spain is what it looks like at the moment. And Bulgaria. I should never forget Bulgaria. It is very strange. We're entering a new era. Not only was it a threat of a French veto, but it is not clear that they could have gotten the 9 votes they needed if there were no veto. So that this is really entering a new stage in which we don't rely anymore on the United Nations. It's America for America.
A little reference to history, too. He spoke about the last century and the generation of appeasement leading up to World War II. He spoke of genocide. Any thoughts on that part of the president's speech?
Well, you know, Michael Gerson is a very good speechwriter with a good sense of history, and he studied a great deal. Indeed, there is a tendency to say, this man, guys like Hitler, if we don't get him early, then he will get us and all the rest of it. Rhetoric.
Dan, I was wondering, he said that the terrorist threat to America and the rest of the world would be diminished the minute Saddam Hussein steps down from power. But at the same time, he seemed to ready the American people for a possible attack.
That's right. And interesting that he asked Saddam Hussein to get out with his sons. Nothing was said about anybody else, the generals and other people in the government. Nobody else gets to get out. They all want these ones. And it is terribly interesting how strong was the appeal made to the Iraqi military. I mean, this is your chance to save yourself. You use some of these terrible weapons, or you do things which we don't like. You are war criminals, and we will prosecute you and take care of you afterwards. That was a very strong statement he made there. I don't know how effective it will be.
This is Michelle Norris. I'm joined by Melissa Block. You're listening to Special Coverage on NPR News. We have in the studio NPR's political analyst, Daniel Shore. We're joined by Tom Gelton and also Mara Liasson. Tom, I was just wondering, Dan just mentioned that he spoke directly about Saddam Hussein and his sons, and the president spoke directly to members of the Iraqi military. Has this ever been used to great effect in the past, this psychological campaign that the Pentagon is waging right now with leaflet drops and trying to address the military directly?
Michelle, it's not often the United States goes into a war with the objective of changing a regime. In many ways, the last time this happened was in 1989 when we went into Panama to overthrow Manuel Noriega. And that in that case as well, there was a heavy psychological operation element to it. And the United States made it very clear, the U.S. military, when they came in, also made it clear to elements of the Panamanian Defense Forces what actions they needed to take in order not to get caught in the line of fire. But this is not, there aren't many examples to look to in the past for something like this happening before.
And there will be a dispute over whether the United States has the right under international law to do this without the sanction of the United Nations. U.S. relies on Chapter 7, inherent right of self-defense. Today we've got Kofi Annan challenging that, indicating that there had not been permission. The trouble is that we're now going to have not only a war in Iraq, but we're going to have a war of words in the United Nations as to America's position vis-a-vis the others. I was reminded, by the way, that I left out an important member of the coalition, Australia.
Tom Gelton, we didn't hear a whole lot in the president's speech tonight about the risks U.S. forces might face in this war. Were you expecting to hear more of that? Might that come at a later date?
You know, I think that that's a point that's been made before, that in none of his addresses on this has the president really made a point of preparing the American people for how risky and this operation could be and how many casualties there could be. That has been a criticism. And again, tonight, we did not hear it. I can tell you from speaking to people at the Pentagon that there is a long list of things that can go wrong. And there have been, in fact, some serious setbacks just within the past couple of weeks. For example, there will not be a northern front. U.S. troops will not be coming in through Turkey to establish a northern front against.
There's some late news on that. Turkey has agreed to reconsider that, and it'll be going before fall.
But it is not in time to allow a northern front. All it will really accomplish at this point is overflights. And that is, just to complete the thought, that means that this operation, people have said it from the beginning, an operation without a northern front will be a riskier operation, and it will involve more casualties on the U.S. side.
I wonder if we could tick through some scenarios of how a U.S. military, U.S.-led military action against Iraq would unfold.
This is going to be, again, this is going to be a unique campaign. It's going to begin with what's called a rolling start. In fact, U.S. Forces aren't completely assembled yet, so more forces will be coming in as the campaign begins. Like other operations, it will begin with very heavy bombing. The first targets are always air defense systems to reduce Iraq's ability to defend itself against air attacks. Extremely heavy bombing, particularly in Baghdad, and focused on presidential targets. Now, President Bush did make it clear that the target will be the lawless men who rule the country and not the country itself. There's going to be a determined effort to try to minimize civilian casualties and collateral damage, but it's going to be inevitable because there's going to be heavy, heavy bombing. And then followed very quickly by phase two, which is a ground component of this operation.
Mara, I had a question about the timetable. There's much reporting today about the internal turmoil at the White House about this 48-hour ultimatum. Can you shed any light on that?
You mean whether or not to give Saddam Hussein
or how long the ultimatum was?
Yeah, I think that the thinking was they wanted to give him an ultimatum because that was politically smart to do, give him one last chance to leave the country. That was a way that this could end without conflict. But I think they didn't want to give him too much time so that he could take that time to do more. He's already fortified Baghdad. He certainly is well prepared for war. But I think they wanted to find the appropriate amount of time, and we heard the time, 48 hours, 72 hours, they settled on 48.
And, you know, a point that Dan made earlier, which needs to be underscored, the president said 48 hours, but he also said that the action would begin at a time of our own choosing. It will not begin, therefore, that we are now Monday night. It will not begin before Wednesday night, but there is no guarantee that we'll begin Wednesday night. It could be any time thereafter, and there are some arguments for delaying it for perhaps a few days, if only to sort of increase the nervousness of the Iraqi forces themselves, who don't know when something will be coming.
There were references in the president's speech to Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. Tom, what are you hearing about the likelihood that chemical, biological weapons might be used?
What we're hearing is that there's increasing evidence that Saddam is preparing for the possibility of using him. We really don't know. We know for a fact now that in 1991 he had these weapons. He had probably more of them than he does now. He elected not to use them. So we really can't predict whether they will be used or not.
Can I ask a question? Compare this to the Gulf War, which started with a long session of bombing and then a very short few days of ground war. Will this be different?
This will be different for the main reason that the objective in 1991 was simply to push Iraqi forces out of Kuwait. And in fact, the ground war that you correctly say was only a few days never actually got into any populated areas. It was largely in uninhabited portions of Iraq. And then President Bush at that time, and Secretary of State Baker and General Powell decided to cut it short. They cut it short before they ran into any resistance on the ground. In order for this campaign to be carried through to its conclusion, it'll have to be carried against resistance. So we know it will be longer and bloodier.
Mara, thoughts on how the president's speech and this decision will be received in Congress? We were hearing from the Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle tonight, quite critical of President Bush.
Right now, I think the Democrats' focus is on the failure of diplomacy, and that is where they feel free to criticize the president. Tom Daschle, along with the majority of Senate Democrats, including every one of the potential presidential candidates, with the exception of Bob Graham, but he hasn't actually gotten in the race yet, voted to give the president carte blanche, in other words, to give this President Bush even greater and more leeway to prosecute this war than they did the first President Bush in the Persian Gulf War. So they've voted to give this president the authority to conduct this war without U.N. approval, yet they've been hammering away at him for going ahead without U.N. approval and for failing to get a majority of the Security Council behind him. I think that's going to change. I think once hostilities commence, you're going to see Democrats being more quiet. They're going to support the troops, and they're going to wait to see what happens. I think if this war goes badly, you'll see the criticism start again.
Well, has there also been a lot of criticism from the Democratic side, but not only the Democratic side, about not hearing figures about what the war will cost?
Yes, and I think that they'll push for that. I think one of the things they think is that if the administration came clean and really gave an honest estimate, that the American people would blanch at this. When the when General Shinseki said there would be 200,000 or so troops to secure Iraq in the occupation, he was roundly undercut. But this will be not just a costly war, and the administration says it will come back with a supplemental request to pay for it, but it will be a very long and costly occupation.
I heard a figure of $80 billion today.
Yeah, for the rebuilding of Iraq or for the war itself?
For the war.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we also hear about $10 billion a year for the rebuilding of Iraq.
We can go now to NPR's David Mulpas in Tampa, Florida. He's been watching the president's speech with Boyd Wynn, who served as a U.S. Army helicopter pilot during Vietnam. His son is serving in the military now. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
You're there with Mr. Wynn?
Yes, we're in the living room of the Wynns here in South Tampa tonight, and we've been watching the speech given by the president tonight and just started to reflect on it a little bit as the Boyds think about their son who's in special operations in that region.
Well, let's hear from them. I'm interested to know their reaction to the president's speech.
Okay, I'll put on Boyd Wynn. He's the father.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Wynn. Thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for asking.
I'm interested to know your thoughts on the president's speech this evening as he readied a nation for war.
Well, that's his job. It's a very somber moment. And I think he's going about it in the right way. He's a very serious time, and it's time for serious remarks, which we all heard tonight.
You have particular concerns because you have a son who's now serving in the military. The president talked quite a bit about the threat here in the United States, possible terrorist threat in the United States and elsewhere. We didn't hear much about the threat that the U.S. troops would face in Iraq.
Well, that's true, but face it, Saddam Hussein does have chemical and biological weapons. I think that President Bush did a yeoman's job at talking directly to the Iraqi military and telling them the consequences of what will happen if those are used. And to the rest of the world, an order from Saddam Hussein to use chemical and biological weapons would be an illegal order. However, the threat does exist that our troops, our men and women in the area, who actually shoulder the burden of defending and carrying out and prosecuting the mission that President Bush has given them, will be in harm's way with these horrible and terrible weapons of mass destruction.
Mr. Wynn, do you think that the president laid out a case for going to war at this time? And are you satisfied with the comments that he made about the security council? Or are you perhaps concerned that this may in some way affect our relationship with traditional allies overseas?
Michelle, there's no one that hates war like a warrior. You have to understand that. And I am convinced that the terrorist threats and the threats from Saddam Hussein and his henchmen are a threat not only to the security of the United States, but the security of the free world. I sincerely believe that. And I say that with a heavy heart.
All right, Mr. Wynn, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle.
You've been listening to a special broadcast of President Bush's address to the nation. This is part of what the president had to say tonight.
The United Nations Security Council has not lived up to its responsibilities, so we will rise to ours. In recent days, some governments in the Middle East have been doing their part. They have delivered public and private messages urging the dictator to leave Iraq so that disarmament can proceed peacefully. He has thus far refused. All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict commenced at a time of our choosing.
President Bush speaking tonight at the White House. Our special was directed by Bob Boylan, edited by Mary Louise Kelly, and produced by Christopher Turpin and Graham Smith.
With help from Andrea Hsu, Matt Martinez, Lisa Harmon, John Baer, Bill Craven, and Ariana Picari. Engineers include Marty Curcius, Michael Cullen, Abdullah Rufus, and Mitch Eaton.
Our coverage of the looming war with Iraq will continue tomorrow morning. I'm Michelle Norris with Melissa Block, and you're listening to NPR News.